This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The U.S. Supreme Court handed down its decision in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954. The landmark ruling found state-sponsored racial school segregation laws unconstitutional. Almost 50 years later, how has the decision affected America? How is it viewed today? We take up those questions in this portion of the program. Our guest is historian James Patterson, author of Brown v. Board of Education, A Civil Rights Milestone and Its Troubled Legacy. Listeners, your questions and comments are encouraged this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The author of 8 books, James T. Patterson, won the Bancroft Prize in History for Grand Expectations, the United States, 1945 to 1974. His other books include America's Struggle Against Poverty in the 20th Century and America in the 20th Century, A History. He is Ford Foundation Professor of History at Brown University. Those telephone numbers again, 333-9455. That's the number to call if you're listening in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Patterson, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you.
Would you give us a sense of how Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka was greeted by political leaders and the public, black and white, when it was handed down in May of 1954?
Sure. The decision was, needless to say, received with jubilation by Thurgood Marshall and the other mostly African-American attorneys who had been waging the 5 suits which made up Brown versus Board of Education for many years prior to the decision in 1954, which, as you know, was unanimous and therefore received quite a bit of play. The shrewder among these people, like Marshall himself, for instance, were well aware that it was just the first step in what was going to be a long, hard road as they faced considerable resistance, mostly from whites in the South. But publicly, at least, they were, you know, jubilant and predicted that segregation would be wiped out in a few years, that this was the greatest thing since the Emancipation Proclamation and so forth. The Eisenhower administration, however, was not altogether happy with the decision. Eisenhower really truly believed that this was not the way to promote better race relations, that it would stiffen Southern resistance. Never during the next 6 years of his presidency did he endorse the decision. He said he would enforce it if he had to, which he did in Little Rock in 1957. But not because he believed the court had done the right thing, but because he felt in Little Rock as commander-in-chief that he had no choice but to send in troops to carry out the token integration that was taking place in Little Rock. And, of course, Southerners were strongly against it, and many of them vowed that they would simply never permit desegregation to occur. So you definitely had a mixed bag in 1954.
Yeah. Was Eisenhower interested in better race relations?
I think he was, but he didn't think it was the role of public authorities, especially the national government, to do a whole lot to bring it about. He did a few things which he had the power to do as chief executive to bring it about, for instance, desegregating veterans' hospitals and that sort of thing under the control of the federal government. But he honestly felt that that people's behavior changed, that is to say, how they would treat black people, for instance, only as their attitudes had changed first. And, of course, the whole point of Brown versus Board and of Thurgood Marshall and of Earl Warren's decision was that, no, behavior doesn't await changed attitudes. You force the changes in behavior, as by a Supreme Court decision, for instance, or later by a Civil Rights Act, And only then can you expect attitudes grudgingly to change.
Yeah. It seems to me that that makes sense, that the status quo doesn't change until something shakes up the status quo.
Well, that was certainly, you're certainly right insofar as Brown versus Board was concerned, because 10 years after the decision in 1964, if you looked at the 11 states of the old Confederacy, the percentage of black students who went to schools with as many as one white child was 1% throughout the South. And in the Deep South states, the really Deep South states, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, there were none. So this was a very slow process.
Did the justices at all wonder about the implementation and the enforcement of their decision?
They absolutely did. They, in fact, first heard the arguments on the case in December of 1952. This was when Fred Vinson was Chief Justice. They recognized they weren't ready to make a decision when they talked about it after that hearing, and they scheduled another for the fall of 1953, which was then postponed when Vinson died and Warren took over. And these took place in December of 53, and then the court needed another 5 months before it reached its decision in May of 1954. And even then, the judges refused to specify how the decision was to be carried out, and they asked for still more hearings later in 1954, which were held to figure out how the decision would be carried out. And the result of that was the second Brown decision, Brown Roman numeral 2, of May 1955, a year later, which specified that desegregation should be carried out with a famous phrase, all deliberate speed. Deliberation, of course, means carefully. Speed means quickly. This was a very ambiguous, unclear set of guidelines and created no end of trouble. Yes, they were very aware of Southern resistance, and nobody more so, for instance, than Hugo Black, who was an ardent liberal and strongly in favor of the decision. But he was raised in Alabama, and he very well knew that there was going to be fierce resistance to the decision.
Yeah. That phrase, with all deliberate speed, did the court realize when it drafted that language that it was ambiguous? Was that on purpose?
That's a bit hard to say. The decision has, I mean, the phrase has a history going back for other purposes earlier in judicial history. I don't think they felt that the decision would be, I mean, that phrase would be as confusing as in fact it was. But yes, they were frightened in 1955 and reluctant to be more specific than that. The decision not only was vague with that language, but it did not offer or require any timetable to be followed. In other words, all deliberate speed wasn't followed with the phrase, all deliberate speed, providing that everything is done by date X, okay? And so there was really open-ended.
No deadline set.
No.
Given that the court took so long to make its decision, is it surprising that the court ruled unanimously?
Everybody was surprised at the time. There was a real division on the court in 52 and 53. Most of the judges opposed segregation by law, which the decision, of course, ultimately said was unconstitutional. Some of them were not certain that the court ought to be the institution to step up and take the heat on this. Others, for instance, like Robert Jackson, a liberal, appointee of Franklin Roosevelt from New York, was certainly no friend of segregation, but felt that any decision overruling prior precedent on this business, which had set up the notion that segregation was all right, providing it was equal, this was the notion of separate but equal, he felt that the court should simply state that it was making a political statement and not try to pretend that there was any judicial precedent to back it up. And Felix Frankfurter had a lot of worries on the same ground. He was an advocate of judicial restraint, and he really would have preferred that attacks on segregation take place as a result of laws passed by democratically elected state legislators and the Congress. Of course, that wasn't happening.
Yeah.
So, and then there was a man by the name of Stanley Reed, who was a Kentuckian, and he was very reluctant, and it took Earl Warren much of that time between the December hearing and the May decision for Warren to wheedle Reed into agreeing to make it a unanimous decision. Everybody felt, Warren felt in particular, the court had to speak unanimously on the case. But yes, there was a lot of internal division.
Mm.
And my book deals a lot with that.
Yeah. And Earl Warren, he was new to the post of Chief Justice,
yes.
Too.
Yes, he'd been appointed following Vincent's death. Vincent died in September of 1953. Warren was nominated in October of 53, but he wasn't confirmed as Chief Justice until March of 54. So, yes, the Brown case was his first important decision. He wrote it himself and delivered it himself.
Hmm. Historian James Patterson is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his latest book, Brown versus Board of Education, A Civil Rights Milestone and Its Troubled Legacy. Listeners, we invite your telephone calls in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, anywhere else toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. A listener is waiting to talk with us in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I grew up in the South in the wake of the Brown decision. In fact, I started school, public school, in 1954. And I graduated from high school in 1966 in Arkansas. And with all deliberate speed was interpreted in my part of the country, Southern Arkansas, as not having any force in effect whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a segregated school system, separate and unequal, clearly separate and unequal, for all 12 years.
Yes, I'm not surprised. As I mentioned, this was the case in all the Deep South states, and as you say, in significant parts of states like Arkansas.
And I was 100 miles south of Little Rock when Little Rock Central was integrated under United States 101st Airborne Supervision.
Yeah.
That played out in this ugly form and didn't ripple across the state whatsoever. The governor was very popular at that time as he was a racial demagogue, Governor Orville Faubus. All through my county and my city, there were impeach Earl Warren signs on many vehicles owned and operated by whites.
Yes, as you probably know, the irony is that when Faubus was first elected governor in 1954,
I believe.
He was regarded as a moderately progressive man.
Absolutely.
Interested in improving state services and education. And he felt in 1956-57 that if he went along with desegregation, he was going to get voted out. And so his actions were very literally demagogic. They were done, not that he was a fan of desegregation. He wasn't, but he was really not nearly as much of a fireball opponent of Brown versus Board in 1954 as other Southern governors had been.
Correct.
And he was elected, as you point out, several more times, I think, he was governor until around 1966, 64, somewhere in there.
Right, and finally, in terms of the legacy of Brown v. Board, and I'm an attorney, and Brown v. Board is sometimes considered the beginning of the Second Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a failed reconstruction, in my point of view, even with respect to the integration of public schools, not only in the South, but also in the West, the East, and particularly in the Midwest metropolitan areas, or major cities like Chicago and Milwaukee, for example. But in the South, I just had a talk to a friend recently who attended a high school graduation at one of the significant high schools in a significant city in Arkansas, and he said the senior class was virtually all black.
Mm-hmm.
White people have gone to Christian academies, they've gone to suburban areas where there are predominantly white people, and they manipulate the residency requirements so their kids can go to those basically monochromatic schools.
Yes. Yes, that's true.
So Brown v. Board, and I'm sure Justice Thurgood Marshall really would rue the day that of what's happened, has not changed the hearts of people in terms of want to be, live in a one-on-one integrated society.
I think it's changed some. If you look at public opinion polls, if you believe them, my book, for instance, has some of these in its appendix. When people were asked in the early 50s, you know, would they send their kids to schools with black kids and so forth, and they broke this down nationwide and by section, the percentages who said they would were far lower then than they subsequently became. You might argue, and so might I, that what people say and what they do are two different things.
That's my point.
But I think there has been some change.
Okay.
Certainly, I think there's some change. Now, you live there and I don't. See if you agree with this, that some of the things which the civil rights movement did in the South, notably, for instance, through the Civil Rights Act of 1964, in doing away with segregation in public accommodations, restaurants, hotels, public transportation, public buildings,
right,
swimming pools, parks, golf courses, and also in requiring honest voting in the South. I mean, we're light years away from where we were in the 50s.
Oh, of course. And of course,
what hasn't changed as much, and you're right, is the situation in schools.
That's correct.
And this is another point I'd like to make, and I take up in the book, that some people since have argued, and a few thought about it at the time, that if you really wanted to make a dent in racial segregation, either in practice or in attitudes, probably the most difficult and most counterproductive place to start that process would have been in public education. And they argued that you should have done it gradually, you know, dealing with public accommodations. People are much more willing to eat in the same restaurant with people of a different color than they are to go to school with them. That maybe some of this would have rubbed off and some of the problems we had would have been different. I don't actually believe that, but some people argue it.
Well, thank you, sir. I wished I could say something rosier about Brown v. Board and its legacy, but as I see it play out all across the country, schools are becoming more and more resegregated. And
that's
this
true.
Is especially true in the South, where segregation has been such an intractable problem.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's talk with another listener, this one in Urbana, on line two.
I can't hear him. Hello?
Hello?
I can't hear him.
Hello?
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 Hello? I can hear you, but I can't. You can't hear me.
Oh, I can hear you.
Well, I can't hear the man who's talking.
Oh, okay. Hello?
I'm here.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, hi. This is I'm calling you from Urbana.
Okay.
I'm at the University of Illinois, and my specialty is literacy.
Yes.
And I've actually read your book.
Thank you.
And what concerns me most is not, I wouldn't want to talk about the history so much as the educational policy conclusions you come to at the end,
mm-hmm.
where you suggest that desegregation will eventually happen if literacy test scores even out between blacks and whites. And I was looking at your notes for this, and I noticed you relied mainly on very conservative commentators such as James Traub and Abigail Thurnstrom for these conclusions. James Traub is famous detractor of affirmative action, as is Abigail Thurnstrom, and people here remember her as one of the two people on the U.S. Commission of Civil Rights who voted against banning Native American mascots in sports, which is a big issue here. And I was just wondering where you stood on affirmative action on and such issues and why you were drawn to these accounts particularly, whereas in the world of literacy research, these people are seen as, you know, the far right corner.
Well, I don't know about Traub, but, you know, certainly that's Abigail Thurnstrom's reputation. I don't think I tried to say that once black and white test scores, for instance, narrowed significantly, assuming that they do, that our problems would go away. Mm-hmm. What I tried to say was that so long as these gaps persist, and indeed to the extent that they may be increasing, this presents a real hurdle, a real obstacle for people who want to push for desegregation in their communities for all the reasons I mentioned. Mm-hmm. Parents, white parents would say, why should I send my kid to a school where people can't read very well? It's just going to drag down the whole level of the curriculum. It's going to dumb down the education they get, and therefore they wouldn't go for it. That's what I meant by that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, would you disagree with that?
Yeah, I would. I think, you know, what the last caller said about Brown not changing a lot about the hearts and minds of people, I don't think changed literacy test scores are going to do it either. It's kind of a tail wagging the dog argument. And the history that you uncover, which is, you know, just rife with examples of whites investing in ways to preserve literacy for whites, a lot of literacy research that shows that African Americans have never been able to capitalize on their literacy in the ways that whites have.
Yeah.
And I don't see anything in the history that really changed that situation.
Well, you know, I arrive at a comparably pessimistic conclusion as yours. I mean, my point is, it would be good somehow or other if we could narrow these gaps one way or another, because I think this would, I'm not going to, as I say, it's not going to change the world, but I think mm-hmm. it would cut back to some degree one of the many arguments that whites use to stop their kids from going to school with blacks.
And you don't think they'll find others?
Yes, I do. And as you point out, my book has a lot of examples.
Okay.
What would you do?
I would really question the literacy standards and think about, you know, the civil rights movement was initially, you know, casting scrutiny on anything that had a racially disparate impact. And somewhere along the line, I got flipped around to looking at, you know, putting under scrutiny anyone who was an affirmative action program or things like that. So it kind of got backwards. So I'd like to see more scrutiny upon those test scores that have racial disparate impact. And
do you think they're culturally biased?
I don't even know so much as culturally biased, but definitely people are in situations where, you know, their approach to those tests isn't, you know, not coming out of the same kind of preparation. They're not investing in, you know, Kaplan in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's lots of other things that could be looked at, I think, besides, you know, reinscribing the myth that literacy is somehow going to, you know, lift people into a situation where they're not going to feel this, you know, racism anymore.
Well, again, I would say that it's certainly not the only thing I would want to see happen, and nor is it the only thing I talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, though, that this is a problem. I don't think the tests are culturally biased. Certainly the math and science tests aren't. And I think that reading skills, the reports that we have of the reading skills of blacks and whites at the age of 17, for instance, are very disturbing. And we should figure out some ways of doing something about it. And
okay.
Here's where I do cite Traub, as you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
Because I wouldn't go as far as he does. He almost really wants to take these kids away from their parents and put them, you
yes.
know, into some kind of an orphanage at the age of three. That's crazy. But it does start very, very young.
Uh-huh.
And one of the points I'm making is if we can somehow develop preschool and early school education on a much better funded level and with a higher level of, I think, there's debate about this, as you know,
mm-hmm.
a higher level, I think, of cognitive content, that this might help a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I meant.
Okay. I just wanted to say that there's a whole world of literacy research in there that, you know, you might look at that
All
would
right.
complicate this quite a bit. But thank you for responding.
Okay. Hello?
Hello, Professor Patterson?
Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. We're having a little technical problem here and there this afternoon. My apologies for
All
that.
Right.
I wanted to ask you, in Washington, D.C., recently, some education leaders and politicians have been talking about starting kids in full-day kindergarten at the age of 3. What are your thoughts about that proposal?
Well, were you able to hear my last comment with
it? Yes.
Yeah, well, the previous caller is certainly right. I'm not an expert on this, and you probably should ask her. But I do know enough to know that there are people out there like James Traub, whom I mentioned, who wrote this strongly argued article in the New York Times Magazine a couple of years ago on the subject, who really do believe strongly that that's the way to go, that there has to be a major focus on preschool, age of 3, age of 4, whatever, year-round, all day, or, you know, heavy cognitive kinds of things. But then there's another whole school of people, as I understand it, who think this is not the way to go, that kids learn at their own level when they're ready to learn things, for the most part. In Sweden, for instance, up until recently, kids have not often started school until they're 7 or 8, and they don't have a big literacy problem. So that's an area of specialized expertise that I'm not an expert.
Fair enough.
I certainly do reiterate what I said, though, to the previous caller. I think that so long as the perception exists of this gap, and I think it's a real one, the potential for reversing the slide back towards segregated schools, which has been taking place for the last decade or so, we're going to have a problem.
Well, not only does it affect parents, white parents, it also affects teachers and how they see their students.
Mm-hmm. True.
Let's talk with another listener on line 1, a caller in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I just wanted you to take a minute or two, if you can. I don't know if you researched this angle or not, but I always wanted to know or to get some sort of overview of how, whether or not the justices had a work were realized that this wasn't only a problem with blacks, and that did they realize that that other groups, ethnic groups or nationalities might want to take advantage of Brown versus the Board of Education, and B, if you give some sort of just a rough quick and dirty idea of what happened? How did the other groups kind of jump on the bandwagon? Was it really hard for them? Is it still hard for them? That kind of thing.
Yes, the you no doubt know this, but maybe I wasn't clear in my earlier comments. We haven't talked about it. The decision, of course, was aimed only at legally mandated racial segregation of whites and blacks, which existed in 1954 in all of the southern states, plus parts of 10 others and the District of Columbia. This was a very widespread practice involving almost 40% of American public school children in 1954. But the focus was only upon these laws. So in places where you had schools with very different levels of funding and quality of teaching and size of libraries and laboratories and so forth, where the direct cause was not a law, as for instance in large parts of Texas where there were large numbers of Mexican Americans, or in California, or in increasingly in some of our cities. Brown versus Board had nothing to say. And so this was not an issue in 1954. It was not something that was part of the Brown versus Board case. And while there are some state law decisions, in fact, one in California about the same time dealing with, actually in the late 40s, dealing with Mexican-American schools, and they called for an end of segregation there, the Supreme Court was not involved with that in 1954. And the real concern about other groups comes later.
Hmm. Well, that's very illuminating for me. I didn't quite realize that, but I didn't understand that there weren't laws, because I understood that at least in some instances, there were laws. I mean, they actually spelled it out, but I'm going to have to bow to your expertise, sir. I don't really know. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Did Brown help the country move toward the civil rights movement of the 1960s?
Well, that's a major question. My book is the first in a series put out by the Oxford Press, the series is entitled Pivotal Moments in American History. And when I agreed to do the book a few years ago, I certainly began with the assumption, I've been teaching American history for a long time, that the Brown case was a pivotal moment. And it is, I think, probably the single most significant Supreme Court decision in 20th century American history. On the other hand, as I mentioned before, it did not affect racial segregation in the American public schools at all in the South. There were some changes in the border states, but even there, some of this change could be very slow in predominantly black districts. And so I wondered how pivotal it was. By the late 1950s, in fact, it seemed as if various agitation for civil rights, which had seemed promising in 1954, was petering out. You'd had the Montgomery bus boycott in 1956, but there seemed to be a quiescence in 1958-59 after Little Rock, and it was very much of a surprise to people in 1960 when the sit-ins electrified activists and promoted a great increase in civil rights activity. So it's not so easy to see the Brown case leading to the next step. I'm more inclined to say the real key was the activism of people on the ground, civil rights activists in the early 60s. To be sure, the Brown case was symbolically important. It was encouraging. But it hadn't helped any of them. If they'd grown up in the South, they went to segregated schools. And increasingly, they felt that legal strategies, such as Thurgood Marshall had employed, were far too slow and ultimately ineffective, and you had to get out there on the streets.
What led to, I guess you just answered that question, the fact that pressure wasn't brought to bear on the legislative branch and the executive branch until the 60s, when people got out there and rode the buses and sat in at restaurants, that kind of thing.
That's right. Yeah. The real change occurs once the civil rights movement forces passage in 1964 of the Civil Rights Act, and then in 65 of the Voting Rights Act. And in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, there were clauses which permitted the United States government to deny federal funding to institutions which segregated. And the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, as it was then called, now Health and Human Services, interpreted this in the Johnson administration. It was a very strongly liberal group to mean that federal aid to education, which became larger after passage of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965, should not go to segregated schools. And so they put a lot of pressure on the school districts and on the school boards. At the same time, various southern district courts and issuing stronger decrees based upon new guidelines which the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare was drawing up in 1964, 65, 66, and 67. And then the Supreme Court jumped into the act itself in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brown, together with the legislation you mentioned, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, these had a dramatic impact on the South and schools in the South, but schools in the North skated.
Yes, yes, they did.
How come?
Well, as I mentioned before, they did not have state laws mandating school segregation. There were a lot of municipal ordinances and zoning practices and school siting practices and transportation route practices, which were done by municipal governments, supported, of course, by public tax dollars, which had an effect fairly similar in many northern areas to the more rigid kind of segregation that was mandated in state laws in the South. But there was a difference. And as I mentioned before, the Supreme Court decision in Brown did not affect these northern areas. Now, Thurgood Marshall, well, not Marshall, he was on the Supreme Court himself by that time, but the NAACP and the Legal Defense Fund began challenging this de facto school segregation in the North in the 60s in particular, in the 70s. But the Supreme Court ruled in 1974 in a case involving Detroit, which was increasingly black, surrounded by increasingly all-white suburbs, that there was no requirement, according to the Constitution, no constitutional requirement that these suburban white districts must amalgamate with Detroit to form one large suburban/urban metropolitan school district, which would be operated as a unit and involve busing throughout the suburbs and the city. The court decided in a 5-4 decision in 1974 that the Constitution said nothing about education, which it didn't, of course. There were very few public schools, to really no public schools in when the Constitution was founded. And the judges read that literally. And ever since 1954, this decision, Milliken versus Bradley, has essentially made it very difficult for metropolitan desegregation to take place. So when you have demographic changes, as you do in Detroit, which is now 90% black, they go to schools which are 90% black. Yes, they skate.
Thurgood Marshall argued the case in front of the court. He was an attorney for the NAACP, and of course he won the case. Later he became a Supreme Court justice. At the end of his tenure as a justice, what were his thoughts about Brown?
He of course, was very proud of what he had done and continued, in fact, to believe strongly in the utility of the legal strategies which he'd been so much a part of. He was somewhat cool for that reason to activists like Martin Luther King and dismissive of people like Malcolm X. He continued to be a strong advocate of desegregation and of the role of the courts in promoting it. He also became increasingly bitter, and decisions like Milliken versus Bradley, from which he dissented in 1974, for instance, as a Supreme Court justice, really discouraged him. And by the time he left the court in 1991, he was a very tired and worn-out justice. He had moved, however, from a position of supporting desegregation to a position in favor of affirmative action, which was a rather typical odyssey, a rather typical change in position or in emphasis of many advocates of civil rights between the 1950s and the 1970s. But he continued to be a supporter of desegregation and of whites and blacks going to school together. He never became an advocate of black separatism or anything like that.
Yeah. Although today a fair number of educators, African-American educators, have argued that black students would be better served in all black schools.
Yes, Clarence Thomas, who took Thomas's place, took Marshall's place as a Supreme Court justice, argued pretty much that in a case which I talk about, Missouri versus Jenkins in 1995. In which he argued that, yeah, well, there's nothing that says that sending a black kid to school with whites or to a predominantly white school is going to make them better kids or make them smarter or better educated, and that we shouldn't be hung up on these questions of what percentage of black kids are in white schools and what percentage of white kids are in black schools. What really matters is the quality of education, and many black schools run by black educators, he argued, do as good, if not a better job, than whites. And you're right, this is a not uncommon attitude, although I think it's still a minority attitude among blacks.
Mm-hmm. What are the attitudes today of those who survive, who were involved in bringing Brown versus Board of Education? How do they feel all these years later?
Well, sadly, of course, most of them are dead. But I do cite some of them, for instance, the so-called Little Rock Nine, the nine first graders who were used to, the nine high school kids who were used to bring about token desegregation of Central High School in Little Rock in 1957. One of them, Elizabeth Eckford, you've probably seen the famous picture of her being spat upon and shouted at by white mobs, is embittered, and I quote her as saying she doesn't think it's done very much, and when her kids went to school in Little Rock, they were bused longer distances to worse schools, and as she put it, she thinks blackness is more important now than she did then. But the other eight went on from Little Rock High School, Central High School, graduated from college, did well, and are pleased and proud to have been part of this procedure. Linda Brown, who was the Brown of Brown versus Board of Education, she was a first grader in 1952 when the litigation started, and a third grader in 1954, has been very ambivalent about it. She understands why her parents did this, but she too, like Elizabeth Eckford, is not sure that it's made a big difference in the quality of education or in racial attitudes in the United States. But you can find very mixed opinions, and I don't have any numbers. I don't know how one would get them. You know, what percentage thinks this or that? There's a spectrum of opinion.
Yeah, I have not read the decision itself. I was curious, though, if in the ruling the word integration was ever used.
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. Desegregation certainly was. Segregation certainly was. But I think what you're driving at is that one could argue, I would argue, that there's a difference between desegregation and integration.
Mm-hmm. Because even in schools that I've been in where the school is integrated, within the school there is great segregation, self-segregation, and also segregation imposed upon the students.
That's true. That's true. There are some success stories, but in general, that's true. So even if you desegregate an individual school and work very hard to provide percentages of white and black kids in rough accordance to the percentage of school-age kids in the school district, as you say, you'll very often have this tracking in classes, college routes, non-college routes, so forth. And that, of course, existed in single-race schools, and usually was a function of class, and it, to some extent, still is.
It still is, yeah. If you go into schools with open campuses at the high school level, for example, in the lunchroom, having state-supported lunch programs, it's going to be the poor kids, and it's largely African-American kids, and the more affluent kids are out at the fast food joints.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are class issues and cultural issues.
There certainly are.
At work as well.
I think that Marshall and the people really did not appreciate the many fundamental problems involved in all of this. They were a little bit naive.
One more question before we go, and I don't know if this is a question you can at all answer, but have there been polls done about our attitudes as Americans toward how deep or how shallow our commitment to integration is?
Oh, yes. I I rely very heavily toward the end on a book by a man by the name of Orlando Patterson, no relation to me. He's a very distinguished sociologist at Harvard. And he wrote a book on, I forget the title of it, on integration and desegregation a few years ago. I also have poll data in my book. The support for desegregated schools, for sending your kids to, if you're white kids, to black schools, as I mentioned before, has been generally much higher since the civil rights activism of the early 60s in this country, not changing much since then, than it was in the 1950s on a whole range of questions that one might ask. And the same thing with the Civil Rights Act. I mean, almost nobody today, and almost nobody in the past 30-odd years, wants seriously to roll back those laws. So, as I mentioned to the first caller, there are a lot of results in polls which indicate that attitudes have changed significantly since Brown versus Board, although not necessarily because Brown versus Board. People will say one thing and do another.
Well, that was at the heart of my question. You know, is to have an attitude is one thing; to have a commitment is something entirely different.
That's right,
Professor Patterson. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
James Patterson has been our guest this afternoon. He is a professor of history at Brown University and the author of Brown v. Board of Education: A Civil Rights Milestone and Its Troubled Legacy.